Welcome to the West Highland Way Race Podcasts. I'm John Kinniston, and this is episode 107. Welcome back to our latest podcast. It's now Friday, the 17th of February, 2017. And there we've got an exciting episode for you with an interview with James Stewart. Before we do that, just want to just encourage you and just wonder how your training's going. A few days ago, Murdo McEwen put a post on Facebook on our webpage, on our family page. And it said, 4 months and a bit to race day. How's the training going? And we had a few people commenting. Peter Duggan said, a bit soon for serious training, Murdo. So maybe he's having a later approach. Chuck Gordon, 15 weeks with a taper sounds better, worse. Stephen Brown, I've mainly been practicing on orange and yellow ones. Next month, I move on to black and reds. Finally, in the run-up to the race itself, I'll be working exclusively on green jelly babies, my favourites. So I can see people are taking that post seriously. Fiona Rennie, nice and steady. Alan Kerr, likewise, slow and steady. Lynn Allen, good here, so excited. Leslie McCarroll, slow and steady too, with a string, with a week of skiing chucked in. Diane Bem, really well so far, getting some mountains every few weeks for longer climbs. Nori McKinley, the first five of my 24-week plan have flown by. Cannot believe I'm almost a quarter into it. Brought home an unusual souvenir from an 18-mile muddy trail today, and he's shown a cut somewhere. I can't quite work out what part of the body it is, maybe his foot. Lois Simpson, making progress at last, still prefer the red-black jelly babies. Nicole Brown, it's the end of my VO2 max phase, bring on the tempo. And she's posted a picture of her calendar, which looks very impressive. Lots of different colours on it and for different types of training, so well done. So if you're planning, if you're doing the race this year, we hope it's going really well and that you're well into your training as well. And we will be doing some more training tips along the way in the next few months to help you. This episode, I say, was an interview that I did last night with James Stewart. James won the race in 2016, and he's just won a very iconic race in the States, the Rocky Raccoon 100. And I was really keen to catch up with James and find out how it went. And he very kindly gave an hour of his time, and we had a good chat about the race and why he did it and how he found it and the way it went. And then there's also lots of questions on Facebook. So I've read all those out, and James worked his way through them. Just before I put that podcast on, I just want to just announce exciting news that our new website goes live tomorrow, on Saturday. Big thanks to Louise Jones from Cairn Gorms Futures, who's helped redesign it for us. And Louise and myself have been working hard over the last week or two to try and get all the links and all the pages up to speed and change them. So I hope you like the look of it. If you don't, then just keep it to yourself. But if you like it, let me know, because that's nice and encouraging. No, seriously, if there's things that you don't like or would like changed, then drop us a line and let us know, and we can see what we can do there. Just big thanks as well to those that have supplied photos. We've got some stunning photos on the front page from Stuart McLean and from Clark Hamilton. So they're great. Really thank them for sending those photos. And we've got lots of other photos throughout the website as well. So it's still not too late. If you've got some really good photos that you'd like to see on the website, just send them to me at johnkinniston@westharlandwayrace.org. And I'll see if I can include those on the site in the coming weeks and months. I've tried to check all the links for the reports and the podcasts and various links that we have on the site. We've gone through one of these link checkers as well, and I think we've hopefully caught most of them, or we've corrected them as the website has moved from the old site to the new one. But if you do find a link that doesn't work, again, if you could just let me know and I'll be able to put that right, hopefully. So once again, thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy my interview with James Stewart. Thank you. Okay, it's a real privilege tonight to have James Stewart with us. James won the West Harlem Way race last year in 2016. So I've been wanting to chat to James. We interviewed him after the race, so we got his thoughts on that race. But you've just come back from America a week and a half ago. So we wanted to find out a bit more about this Rocky Raccoon. So just first of all, just maybe for those who don't know you at all, James, just give us a quick introduction of who you are.
Yeah, thanks, and thanks for having me on again, John. So I'm James Stewart. As John says, I was privileged enough to win the West Highland Way in 2016, which is my, I guess, my link and my association with this particular podcast. I am an ultra runner from the village of Croy, which is near Cumbernauld in Kilsyth. I've been running ultras now for about 4 years, only seriously now for a couple of years really. I've been lucky enough to win a couple of races in that time and get to meet and see loads of amazing places and people. So I'm privileged to be fit and healthy and be able to do this stuff, John, and I sincerely love running.
Yeah, great. Well, and I know we've all enjoyed watching that progression over the last 2 years and just what you've been able to achieve and what you will achieve in the future. And we, as a race, we feel very much part of what you're doing. And I think that showed in this last race, the amount of people on Facebook that were following you, and we'll maybe come on to that. But the first question I had, James, was why the Rocky Raccoon 100?
There was a number of things. And I would urge everyone to do this, but I have a list of goals and experiences I want to do so that each year I sit down and look at what I had and what I've got and the things that I want to nail. And one of them was a 100-mile race in America. So, I had that on my list. And I was looking at what the options were for 2017. One of them would have been to enter the ballot for Western States, but I didn't do that. Another one would have been maybe to do something in the second half of the year. And I couldn't find one that I wanted to do. And then when I was looking through the first half of the year, Rocky Raccoon jumped out at me. Now, for people who don't know Rocky Raccoon as a race, it's a very iconic 100-miler in the States. And it also doubles up as the US National Trail Championships. So they run the 100-mile national championship on that day on that course as well. So that's part of the race. And that meant that I was running a race where there was going to be a good field and also that it was a world-recognised event. It's well-known for being very fast. And just to give you an idea of some of the past winners, just over the last 6 or 7 years, I think Ian Sharman's won it 3 times. Hal Kohner's won it. Anton Kaprichka's won it. Matt Lay, who won the fling, I think, a couple of years ago, he's won it as well. So it's a race that tends to attract a decent field and has got a big reputation. Mm-hmm. So it fitted timing-wise as much as anything else, but it just fitted nicely in that regard.
Yeah, excellent. And obviously we'll find out how it all went and what you thought of the race. But I just wanted to go back a few weeks or months in a sense and just think about your training plan. And I know you did these V-blogs, which I love them. I love watching them. It was great. And you were sharing every 2 weeks or so, wasn't it?
Thank you.
Your sort of training and your thoughts, and you got your boys asking questions. It was great. And I think that was one of the things that helped us all feel part of what you were doing. But just tell us a little bit about your training plan, maybe some of the key highlights in that progression as you work towards the race.
Yeah, so I decided to enter Rocky Raccoon just after I'd run Tootenbeck, track 24. So, and that starts to be, that's the genesis of the training period, if you like. So mid-September 2016, the track 24-hour race was my big aim for last year, actually, my stated aim at the start of the year between myself and my coach. And I came out of that race feeling great and decided, that's when I decided to punt at America, something in America, first half of the year. So the first thing, though, the first part of my training block was about recovery, was about being ready to put together a good 12 to 14 weeks of training. And I think that's really important. And I know I talked about this on the West Highland Way podcast as well, but it's really important that you take the time to recover. Now, I'm lucky in the sense that it's widely known, and most of the people who know me personally know that I'm coached by Paul Giblin, who has a rather deep and famous connection with the West Highland Way, of course, having won it 3 years in a trot and course record holder and what have you. So Paul and I discussed during Rocky Raccoon, and we agreed that whilst the timing was tight, the condition had been in through the year, and with a good set of recovery, it should be doable for us. So a good few weeks of recovery to start with, which is probably not what people expect to hear, John. Then, after that, starting to rebuild, the go through a build phase to get, you know, the strength in the legs, get the endurance back, and then a period for about 6 weeks from early December through to late to mid-January, where it was all about building the endurance, the long runs, the speed, and a big focus on improving my speed in particular, which is something Paul had been keen to work on with me. So what that meant was I trained probably not the same level of miles as I did going into the West Highland Way, but the intensity was a notch up because there was a lot more long runs with, you know, long, hard efforts in them and stuff. And it was a really, really, it's probably the best training block I've had over the last few years. It was probably the best shape I've been in going into any race, was going into Rocky Raccoon as a result. But I'm lucky I don't have to think too much about training. I sound as if I know what I'm talking about, but really I'm rehashing what I get told about what I have to do.
Yeah, because in a sense, the Tooting Beck was round a track, wasn't it? And it's flat, and it's a different type of race to the West Highland Way, and different type again to the Rocky Raccoon. So presumably your training has to be specific for whatever race you're doing.
Yeah. There's elements of that, and absolutely. So for you know, if you go back to the West Highland Way, there was a lot of training involved where I would have specific goals around elevation. For Tooting Beck, it was all about clearly endurance was a big thing, but being able to maintain speed at a certain level. And then for Rocky Raccoon, it was probably in between both. So it was a mix of some of the long runs I would do, would go on trail. So I did a 38 mile run on the West Highland Way from, I can't even remember where I went to, but 38 miles on the West Highland Way, going up over Connick and up to Salke Bay and beyond and back and what have you. But also lots of long runs, 50Ks and the canal and stuff, where it was like, you know, the flat was good because I could get good leg turnover. So it was almost in between what you would do for a track and what you would do for a West Highland Way. It was how I trained for Rocky Raccoon.
Yeah. Well, it sounds though you were in great shape when you went. And just these videos, was that something that you just enjoyed doing, or what was the motivation behind doing those?
So I've always kind of enjoyed writing, and I'd been writing obviously blogs and race reports, and they were kind of running the mill, and I'd kind of decided that I've got, obviously with the two boys, Ewan and Caelan, and they're 5 and 9 now, so they're kind of getting to understand some of the stuff I get up to, and I wanted to make the point that to run well, if you're dedicated to it, you can run well and have a life at the same time, and it is possible to achieve balance. And I thought the best way to demonstrate that wasn't to tell people, because it's kind of almost exposition when you put it down on paper and go, and I do this and I do that, but by doing it through video, you were showing people the kind of the mix and the balance. And clearly I was trying to show the mix of, you know, I'm getting up early, I'm up at 4:30 to go training, but at the weekend I'm still spending a lot of time with the boys, and I get them involved and stuff. So kind of stuff like that I was keen to get into. And I hope I got that balance right.
Yeah, and it's a great record, isn't it? Because I know that's something I've enjoyed doing as well since I've been involved. And I've got a record now of a lot of blogs and videos, and they're quite fun to look back on, aren't they?
They are, and that's another motivation. 10 years' time from now, the boys, you know, I mean, hopefully not in 10 years' time, because they'll be 15 and 19, but maybe 15, 20 years' time from now, they might be sitting showing their grandkids videos of me and grainy old YouTube videos of training and stuff, you know, with a sense of pride, I hope.
Yeah, well, that's where I am now as a grandfather, so it's good fun. Okay, so let's think about the race then. And the first question I had was loops. And, you know, I think to go that far and then just run at 5 20-mile loops, was that something that attracted you, or was that something which was a bit of a negative in your mind?
Certainly not a negative. Having done, I don't know how many, I must have done 540 loops of Tuttenbeck track, so yeah, to only have five. And I'm quite adept at switching off when it comes to loops. Another thing for me, just on the loops at Rocky Raccoon, the first loop is kind of, you do the first half of the loop in the dark, and the last loop, just with the time I was running that, second half's in the dark. So they don't feel like a loop because you're getting a different experience in them. One of the reasons I chose Rocky Raccoon was because it was loops. And when I initially booked a race, I was going out myself. So I just felt as if a looped race with no crew would be easier. If I had to manage myself on the day, if I couldn't pick someone up over there who would be able to support me, it would have been an easier way to manage myself, because I'd have been able to leave a drop bag at one of the aid stations and just walk from there. Yeah. So Rocky Raccoon, actually being loops and not having to have any navigation or any worry like that, that was an attraction in the race.
Yeah, and I suppose because you couldn't recce the route beforehand, could you? So in a sense,
no,
the first loop becomes a bit of a recce, and then you know where you're going after that, don't you?
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, the race director joked before the race, John, and I'd spoke with a guy via email, and I'd wee chat with him a couple of days before the race when I went down to have a look at the course, actually, and he joked at the meeting, and I think the wee look at me when he said it, he says, this course will be marked to within an inch of its life, you it'll be possible for you to get lost. It says, and then he said, it's not like those races in the UK where they tie a yellow ribbon to a tree every 5 miles, whether it's needed or not. and it had a point, because honestly, you couldn't get lost on this course. There was like seven arrows every corner and stuff, and it was so well marked. Once you went round once, it was like, yeah, you can't go wrong. Yeah. Very different. I mean, the West End way is way marked, yeah. But you can understand why sometimes maybe an American might come over here and go, right, that's me been running 500 metres and there's been no mark, am I lost? If you needed to go a different direction, we would have had a mark. Yeah. They operate a bit differently from us in that regard. Yeah.
So is that standard for most ultra races in America?
I suspect so. I think it's they do things differently from us in terms of, you know, the aid station stuff that they do and all that kind of good stuff. And they operate a wee bit differently from us. Neither's better than the other, but in that particular course, one of the things they want to make sure is you don't stray off course. Yeah. And there's alligators in the park, so I guess they've got a bit of motivation to keep you safe.
Excellent. Okay, so what were your targets when you went into that race?
So my target, when I first entered the race, anyone who asked me said, well, this is Rocky Raccoon, you don't know what kind of field's going to be there. So when I first entered the race, I had a kind of bit of a Western States mindset on that said, well, you know what, if you finish top 10 in a race like this, as long as you put in a good account and you're on your best, that might be good. And we'll wait and see how the training goes and the recovery from Tuttenbeck goes before we kind of settle on another target. And then as I got closer to race day, I kind of went to America fancying that I would have a shot at getting on the podium. And if I got a shot at getting on the podium, then clearly you have a shot of being in contention for the race. And a lot of it depends on how other people's races goes and how your day goes. But when I stood on the start line on the morning of the race, I was intent on giving winning the race a bash.
Yeah, excellent. So you were certainly aiming high then.
Well, yeah. I mean, we ended up, my dad and my brother came out with me, so that meant that right away I've got like a 20-minute benefit, because I'm not going to be messing about aid stations. I'm getting bottles and I'm getting through, and they were there to help as well, which was great from just a bit of company and also just a chance to spend some quality time with the guys. But also, it's kind of no point in going all the way over there and you know, not at least going in with a name that, you know, aiming high, and then it's better to aim high and miss than to aim low and, you know, come even lower than that. So I thought I might as well give it a go. I wasn't going to try and blow myself up to try and win the race, but I certainly wanted to be by 60 miles in contention. That was my underlying aim at the start.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a bit of a spoiler alert for anyone who's not followed. You did win the race, and you took 13 hours, 39 minutes and 13 minutes. And I thought it was really interesting just to read out the five loops, because the times you took. So I'll just do hours and minutes. So The first one was 2 hours 25, and then 2:29, and then 2:49, 2:50, and the last one 3:03. So there was, what, 38 minutes between your first one and your last one, but pretty consistent all the way through. So obviously we haven't probably got time to go through every single lap, but just give us the sense of how the race went over those five laps.
So in the first lap, I probably went out a wee bit too quick. So I got caught up in running alongside Zach Bitter, who I'm sure some people who listen to this will be well aware of. And a chap called Mario Meisias, who's he's a former Olympic trialist for America, you know, I think about a 250 marathon or something like that. So I got caught him running with him, but I didn't feel like I was running too hard, but I was slightly inside the time that I wanted to be on in that first lap. So I eased off on the back of that first lap, and that meant that going into the second lap, I eased off and I went into the second lap, and those guys had opened up about 3 minutes of a lead on me. But to my surprise, I caught up with them at about 25 miles. So I'm running along at about 28 miles. I'm running along with both those guys, and Zach went over in his ankle. And that was his race over. He said he was going to walk it off, but he couldn't. So he goes over in his ankle, and then it's just myself and Mario Meisias out in the lead. And we just run together for about 10 miles, not really chatting. He's kind of generally ghosting me a wee bit, so I'm kind of keen for him either to go ahead or to drop back. But at 35 miles, he decides to make a move, which is kind of early, but he does anyway. And he runs really hard. And what's the hardest part of the course? The last 6 miles is probably the hardest part of the course because it's kind of uphill and it's quite rooty. And quite technical in some parts, not scrambling or anything, but you need to watch your footing. And he opens up a bit of a lead, and then he pushes hard on the third loop. And I'm running the third loop pretty comfortably, and I want to run within myself. I've had a wee bit of a rough spell. And by the time I've finished that, so that's 60 miles, he's about 12 minutes ahead of me. But I'm, broadly speaking, where I want to be. I'm running in second place. I've got a comfortable lead over third. And back to what I said earlier, you want to be in contention at 60 miles. And as we all know, in a 100-mile race, 10, 12 minutes, that's nothing. That's one dodgy tummy away from being caught. I get to 63 miles, and there's a checkpoint there, or an aid station, should I say. I get told as I'm crossing the road at the aid station that I'm in the lead. And it was interesting because the last words my dad said to me as I came out of the start-finish that you turn around at for each loop, he said to me that Mario looked as if he was struggling, had to do a bit of stretching, and he got the sense that he'd pushed too hard for the previous two laps. And lo and behold, he must have had done. Now, I know Mario and Zach were going there trying to break course records and stuff, so they'd maybe just pushed a bit hard. And as you know, John, 100-mile races, it's not about how fast you start it, it's about how fast you finish it.
Yeah.
So that meant at 63 miles, all of a sudden I was thrust from being 10, 12 minutes behind to being in the lead.
So did you see him, or did you go past him while he was stopped?
Yeah, I didn't see him stopping, but the way the loop worked is the first 5K is also the last 5K of each loop. So you passed each other as you kind of went in and out the start-finish area.
Right.
So I could work out how far ahead of me he was, and you could get a bead on how he was running. So, but I didn't see him pull out the race, but I did try to make a move at 60 miles to start closing him down. My aim was to, you know, close the gap and then have a really good tilt at the last lap on him. But as it was, it turned out, instead of me being the hunter, I became the hunted.
Right.
And I moved into the lead. And that changes your mindset all in, because, you know, at 60 miles and West Highland Way equivalent, for anyone who wants to try and extrapolate this out into something they're familiar with, that's almost like taking the lead at Bridge of Orkney, which is ironically what I did at the West Highland Way this year as well. So I kind of drew on the experience from the West Highland Way to say, right, okay, become a good front runner now. So the aim was just to continue to run consistently for the fourth lap and work out how much of a, you know, try and keep the same gap that I had on third place, as was, they were now up into second. And then, you know, try and close it out in the last lap. And whilst he's talking about loops, even a 20-mile loop, we actually broke each loop down into three parts. So by the time you're getting into the last couple of loops, you're breaking it down into aid state, start, finish, the first aid station, loop, back to that aid station, back to the start. So you were kind of trying to break the race down into bite-sized chunks. Mm. And I'm in the lead, and I get back to the start, finish, and I get information that at the last aid station, I had a 9-minute lead over second place, which was good. But as I ran out the start, finish, it turned out I only had a 5-minute lead. So and what had happened was the guy who was running in third had jumped up to running in second behind me, and he was running really well. And what these guys had over there as well, John, they had pacers. I didn't have a pacer.
Yeah.
So they've got pacers over there, and he's looking smooth as silk. Ronnie is a graceful runner. Ronnie Delzer, who finished second, looked absolutely serene the way he was running, and that spooked me a wee bit. And I spent the first 10 miles of the last lap waiting on him taking over. Not waiting on him, I was running hard, but I went in there a wee bit of down, both mentally and physically.
Did you look behind you, or did you just try and focus on keeping going?
I just looked ahead. There's no value in looking behind at this stage, because you can't really see. Yeah. There's so many twists and turns, and it's in forests and stuff. You couldn't really look at someone behind you. As I said, when you break the loops down into three, for me, the final loop was broken down from 80 miles to 86 miles. So this takes you to an aid station called Damnation. And that's where my brother was stationed. And when I got to Damnation at 86 miles, I started to feel, right, okay, well, he's not overtaking me yet, so that's good. So he's not closing me down a minute a mile, so that's good, and I'm still running okay. I'm not running overly fast at this stage, but I'm still running kind of sub 9-minute mile pace. And then I take my head torch off my brother because it's going to get dark. Well, I do a 7-mile loop that takes you out the back of the park and brings you straight back to the aid station you've just come out of. Oh. When I come back to that aid station, it was pitch black. Now, that becomes important. And you referenced the vlogs earlier on, John. It was pitch black. And the point where it got dark was when the point where I got really strong again. Conversely, where most people get sleepy when it gets dark, I think because I do all my training in the dark through the winter, it was like familiar territory. I described it in the blog that I wrote as being vampiric in its nature. I got strength from the dark. And I got back to the aid station. I got information that Ronnie had closed me about 3 minutes, and I thought, I've just been through a really tough section, and he's only managed to close me to 3 minutes. And now I feel really strong. I just battered as hard as I could for the last 7 miles to ensure that he couldn't catch me.
Brilliant.
And I was lucky enough to do that for the first four and a half of the 7 miles until I had a bit of an incident with my head torch and batteries, which were running out. And I got really lucky, and I passed a runner called Lauren Welton, whose name will be forever etched in my memory, who happened to have spare batteries, and she was kind enough to give me them, about 4K from the finish, and they saw me home, and I think I won by about 5 or 6 minutes in the end, including a couple of minutes stop to get batteries off a fair maiden.
Yeah. And what was the feeling like of actually getting to that finish line?
Oh, it was awesome. You're thinking, you're running a race there that's well known. It's got a litany of famous winners from international ultra running, guys that we've all looked up to for years. And then it's like you've got this kind of asthmatic 40-year-old from Croy kind of down on the finish line. And the weird thing is that it's pitch black, so no one can see you finishing, because people are coming in and out the start and finish shoot all the time, because they're going out to do their third or their fourth loops whilst you're coming in to finish. And so I was about 50 yards from the line, and my dad was like, is that you, James? And he's standing with a salt tire to throw it at me. I don't know how many times he asked people on the way by if that was me, but eventually it did turn out to be me, and I crossed the line, and it was great to share that moment with Andy and Cookie, because they came over and sacrificed a lot of their time and their own time with their families and stuff to come over and help me turn out to go and win the race. And it was an excellent feeling, really was. I'm obviously very chuffed.
And is there a prize giving the next day?
No, it's nothing like, I was back in the hotel an hour later. It's nothing, they don't do a prize giving at this race, because basically they They're in a state park. It's the middle of nowhere, but it's not the middle of nowhere. You're maybe 10 miles from the nearest town, and there's no places to host all that kind of stuff. So after the race, I get given my buckle, my trophy, and a few other wee things from the race director. Had a good chat with him, sat down, got some water in me, and then suggested to my dad and my brother that we watched the next couple of guys coming through, the guys who finished behind me, watched them coming through, and then we shot off because there was nothing to hang around for, because it's approaching 8 o'clock at night, it's getting dark, it's cold, and I had beers in the fridge back at the hotel.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they were well deserved. Yeah. Did you get the feeling that people didn't quite know who you were and you were a bit of a surprise winner?
Yeah, I think there's more than a feeling to that. I'm pretty sure that very few people in the race would have known who I was. And there wasn't any previews or anything that were calling any the kind of key competition out, either for me to know who I was running against or for them to know who I was. So what was interesting was reading Ronnie's blog after it, the guy who finished second and who by proxy became the American national trail champion over 100 miles. He mentions in his blog that he found out during the race that I'd ran 100 over 160 miles at Tooting, so he knew then there was no chance of me fading, and that's partly what influenced him to push hard in the fourth lap to try and make an impression on me. I'm pretty sure that aside from the race director and maybe one or two other people in the race, I was flying under the radar there.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure next time they'll know who you are.
Yeah, I'll just I'll enter as Jim Stewart and see if they pick me up.
Yeah, yeah. And I would recommend that people read your blog. It's great, you know, your race reports, and you go into detail there as well. So it's well worth a read. Okay, I've just got one more question, and then I'd like to move on to the Facebook questions, because there's a whole variety of there. And that is, what are your plans for this year? You were saying that obviously this was your target for the first couple of months, but what are your plans for the rest of 2017?
I have one race that I have got entered for the rest of this year so far, and that's just a bit of fun. I'm over in Canada on holiday late July, early August, and there's a half marathon on while I'm there, and that's the only race I've got entered officially. And the reason being, John, much like Neil McNichol talked about back when you interviewed him, I think back in December, just after his winter West Island Way escapades, the run at Tooting Bec has put me in has given me the individual qualification standard for the GB 24-hour team, and Rocky Raccoon helps me prove 2017 fitness. So what I'm really waiting on is hopefully, fingers crossed, I'll get selected for that team, and I'll get a chance to run alongside some very famous and brilliant Scottish people who have already represented Britain in the 24-hour genre of our sport in July in Belfast. That's what I'm hoping to do. If I don't get picked for that team, you might find that I'm begging you guys for a place in the West Island Way, because it's a backup, which is the week before the 24-hour championships. But as it stands, I'm kind of holding out for that. If that doesn't come to fruition, I've got a couple of things that I might choose to do. And then on the back of whether I get into that race or not, I'd maybe look to do another 100-miler October, November, but I haven't looked at what that might be yet.
Right. I did see that the Rocky Raccoon is one of these golden tickets for the Western States, isn't it? Is it the top two get a place?
It has been in the past. I don't know if it was this year. It certainly says on their website and all on their paraphernalia that you get with the pre-race stuff, but I wouldn't take that place up for a couple of reasons. One is Western States is the week before the 24-hour champs, and whilst doing Western States is a dream of mine, I think if you get an opportunity to earn a best, you have to take it. I might never get that opportunity again. Western States happens every year. I don't think I could justify the expense or time away from the family to fly over to California or over to the West Coast of America in order to run another 100-miler. It would be borderline selfish. I can get away with Belfast, but I think one stateside trip a year would be my limit just now.
Yeah. Well,
no one wants to pay for it. You know, that's a different matter.
Yeah, we certainly look forward to following how you get on, and hopefully you'll hear fairly soon whether you've got a place in the GB team. But it'll be great to see how you get on there. Okay, let's move on to these Facebook questions then. And we've got a whole mixture of questions, so I think we'll just go in order of when they were posted. And we start with a fun one. Gavin Harvey says, how many Watsits does it take until James is full?
Well, up until the Tuesday after the race, Gavin, I would have said that was a question that has yet to be answered. There was an occasion once when I was travelling to Ireland on holiday where I had a full 12 pack of Watsits on the way over, like 12 individual packets, and you know that was back in my chubbier days. But I managed to do them, and that was a variety pack. I think it was the Flaming Hot Prawn Cocktail and your classic cheese ones, three or four of each. But I got a grab bag packet of Watsits for Christmas, which I think was equivalent of about 5 bags of Watsits, and I'd been keeping them until after the race, believe it or not. And obviously Watsits are a long-standing joke with me. Yeah. So I kept them until after the race, and myself and Louise went to see Trainspotting 2 the day after I flew back from America. The kids were at school, and that was a window of opportunity. And I couldn't finish them.
Oh, no.
I'm ashamed to admit it. I couldn't finish them. And I don't know if it was a cheese overload or my body wasn't ready to take on such a big challenge as to eat. I will point out there was maybe only a meagre handful of two left in the bottom of the bag, but I just couldn't face them. And I actually put them in the bin rather than take them home because it was a bit of an iconic moment for me. Thanks for that, Gavin. I think you've opened up an old sore. That question.
Okay, Keith Mabbitt, you seem to have a plan of a slowing race strategy. I think he's basing that on the splits. Is that based on heart rate zones allowing for a natural slowing, on timing based on a final goal time, or is it in response to the strategy of other competitors?
It's three things. So I don't use a heart rate monitor either in training or in racing. So it's not something I bother too much with. I don't know if I would get any benefit from it if I decided to use it, but it's not something I bother with. But over a 100-mile race, if you look, and I do study times from other competitors when I'm working at a race plan, if you look at any runner, they will slow down over a 100-mile race. It's just natural, especially one that's quite competitive at the front, because you know runners are racing from the off. It's not like you're going out there and like in a leisurely stroll. So you have to have a plan that's got a manageable effort right throughout within that, and there's naturally going to be some fatigue within that. Now, if it was up to 50k, maybe a wee bit longer, I'd have a negative split plan. You know, I'd want to go harder the second half of the race. But once you get to 100 miles, particularly on trail like races like the West Highland Way and Rocky Racuna, you have to slow. It's just a natural phenomenon. But the second thing is that plan that I do write is based on a final goal time. But I do react to what other competitors are doing. So you come out with a base plan for a race of this length and a competition like this, but ultimately, the way I would describe how I build my plan for a race like this is quite simple. It's a pace plan till about 60 miles, till about two-thirds of the way in. Then it becomes a race plan after that. What do I need to do to get the best possible position I can in the race? Right. And that's how I come up with that. So whilst I've got a slowing plan, and I could sit down and talk about this all day long, you'll notice that if you look through the history of Rocky Raccoon in particular, that is exactly what anyone done from when Ian Sharman won it in the American record time, right through any winner from 2010, because that's as far back as I felt I needed to go.
So those splits of 225, 229, 249, 250, 303, were they round about what you were expecting?
They were a tiny wee bit slower, aside from the first one. And the reason being is I'd based my splits on the previous 6 or 7 years' history of the race. But what I didn't realise going into this year was, one, that the course was going to be slightly altered due to some work going on in the park. And that slight alteration meant that the course was about a mile and a half longer than it would normally be. And it had an extra 2,000 feet of climb, so it's 7,000 feet of climb as opposed to the 5,000 it usually has. So when you think about the fact that I'm basing my plan on the history of the race, I'm missing that, that the race previously was probably on a slightly easier course. And 2015 had been run on that Altered course, but I didn't know that. And if I'd have known that, I'd have probably put a wee bit more weight into the 2015's stats. But regardless of that, I wasn't actually that far away from the splits in the main, right up to about 60 miles. And then after that, as I said, John, it was about just running the plan that would keep me in front. I wasn't concerned about trying to hit certain pace zones or anything. It became about all that mattered was finishing any amount of seconds ahead of second place.
Yeah. I must admit, the ones that really impressed me was the third and fourth, to be just a minute apart, and then the last one only 13 minutes slower than your fourth one. You know, as you say, 12, 13 minutes over 20 miles at that stage of the race is pretty impressive. So, yeah, well done.
Thank you.
Okay, John Cassidy, it says, how much was in the tank for the last loop? Would you do anything differently training-wise, knowing what you do know now post-race?
There's two questions there, isn't there? Mm. So first one, John, how much was in the tank for the last loop? There was enough. I wasn't at breaking point. And one of the things I'm most proud of that particular race was I ran every step of the 100 miles, whether it was uphill or downhill, or aside from stopping at aid stations and to get batteries, and my stops at the aid stations were pretty short. I ran every step of that race, and I was really consistent throughout, but I managed my effort really well so that I had to finish in the last 7 miles. When you look at the last lap, I think it was 3:03 for the last lap, but actually the last 7 miles of that fifth lap were at the same pace as I ran the last 7 miles on the third and the fourth laps, in fact slightly quicker.
Wow.
Because I had to push for that, and that's why I managed to open up a bit of lead, and I managed to sustain that even though I had to stop for batteries. And so I walked every step of the race. Another thing I was really, really pleased about was when I looked at my mile splits, there was only 3 miles that were above 10-minute mile pace, and that was 3 miles where I stopped to change tops or something like that, because I didn't stop my watch, obviously. So that was, you could see every one of them was at 20, I think it was at 40, 60 and 80 miles. Which is something to be quite proud of. So I had some in the tank, and I'd managed my effort really well, and that really ties back to Keith's question previously. And would I do anything different with training wise? I'd be frittering around the edges on things. As I said, going into the race, anyone who asked me, I'd met Marco Cassani in the train a few days before flying out, and he'd asked me how I was going, and I was like, I feel as if I'm in the best shape I've ever been in. And with that in mind, there's not a lot of change. Really, really happy with how that went.
Yeah, that's all you can ask for, isn't it, really?
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, this is a bit more of a fun one, I think, from Graham Connolly. Who's your favourite Connolly brother and why?
So Graham Connolly, whenever you see a Connolly's name pop up in a question, you get worried.
So are they good friends of yours, I assume?
Yeah. Both of them. They're a couple of wise guys as well. My favourite Connolly brother, Graham, it depends on what attribute I'm looking for, but my favourite Connolly all in is George Connolly, who I wish I'd seen playing football. I don't know if he's a relation of yours or whether he's maybe you and John's older brother, but I'm going to assume he was your older brother. And George Connolly, who played for Celtic back in the 70s, he would be my favourite Connolly brother if he exists.
No, very diplomatic, well done. Okay, Sarah Self.
I'm getting abuse off him anyway for that answer. It didn't matter what I said.
Oh, no, that's true. Sarah Self, what's your views on pacers at the sharp end of the race? You mentioned that earlier, that others had pacers. Given his experience in races where it isn't allowed, like the West Harlem Way, and in the Rocky Raccoon 100 where it is, and did the fact that the second place runner picked up a pacer at 60 miles change your strategy at all? So that's a good question, isn't it?
It is. And again, there's two questions there, isn't there? First of all, what's my view on pacers at the sharp end of races? Don't agree with it. I think what the West Highland Way race does is absolutely spot on, in the sense that if you're in the competition, and Glenmore does the same thing at the 24-hour race, if you're in the sharp end of the race and you're in competition with a chance of winning or getting a place in the podium, then it's through your own efforts. And then if you're someone who's going to finish in the dark or be a bit further down the field, a pacer is much about your safety as it is about your ability to complete the race. And I think it becomes a different thing. But And I know it's a very American thing, and they subscribe to Pacers, and for some races, actually, they're probably really critical, because the courses themselves, it's good to have a Pacer on, but I personally don't think that Pacers should be allowed at the sharp end of a race.
Yeah. And then the second part was, did it change your strategy at all when you knew the guy behind you had a Pacer?
It spooked me a wee bit. To see him running, I mentioned how smooth Ronnie was running earlier, and it spooked me a wee bit, in as much that part of the kind of mental down I had in the from 80 to about 85, 89 miles was because I felt that he was running well and he had someone there to coax him and cajole him. But then I got my head in the right space, I was like, he's not flown all the way from the UK, he's not got his dad and his brother having made that commitment to come all the way out here. When he lives in Texas, the guy, you know, he's probably drove up in the morning. I've went over and those guys have made that effort, and I became inspired not by the people who were pacing with me on the course, but the people who'd come to me to the course with me. So I used the energy, instead of having them beside me, I used the energy of trying to reach them as quickly as possible. But it did spook me a wee bit, to be honest with you. Because I hadn't even thought about it until I seen him pacing.
That's good. Yeah, okay, thank you. Scott Fergus, James obviously loves trail races and trail running and hills in general. Is he in any way tempted by the more mountainous runs such as UTMB, CCC, etc.? And following on from that, 24-hour races start to finish appears to be a speciality. Would he consider multi-stage day races? So again, there's a couple of questions in there.
Yeah, these people are, you know, taking advantage of your good nature, John, and asking a question. So Scott, UTMB and CCC, I'm just not into that. Kind of fast hiking up hills and all that kind of good stuff. I like to run. I mentioned I like the fact that I ran Rocky Raccoon start to finish 100 miles without walking any of it. That's part of an achievement for me, but also the fact is I can get that 100 miles done in about 13 and a bit hours and get it over with, and you know, I'm not out in the mountains overnight and all that kind of good stuff. And whilst I like hills and I like running up and down hills, I don't like getting to the point where you have to walk up hills and it's like, you know, the only way up over this is to kind of scramble and all that. It just doesn't appeal to me. And I know that's probably sacrilege to some people. It's almost like I'm a mountain running atheist, but that's just how I am with it. I very much doubt you'll ever see me in Chamonix at any of those races. In terms of multi-stage races...
Sorry, can we just ask one question on that? Because I assume you talked with Paul quite a bit about UTMB, because that was the thing that struck me when Paul did it a few years ago, that he's used to running all these races, and then suddenly he had to hype them more. And I wondered whether that, you know, obviously I could ask Paul, but that was the impression I got with him as well. Would that be true, do you think?
I think Paul, aside from Paul being a lot quicker than I, we've probably got quite similar running preferences, in the sense that, you know, something that's got a bit of toughness about it, but it rewards someone who can run on multiple terrain and can be efficient across terrain that's hilly and a bit gnarly, but allows you, if you're good with your footing and all that, to run. You're flat where you can open up a wee bit, or it's got some hills that you can open up going up and down. So there's some similarities there, and it's probably Paul's own personal experience as to what he prefers, but my experience of having seen Paul run at races and where he's performed best at is, I think he's, you know, Western States course is just perfect for Paul. To go there and take fifth in your first year, for example, is amazing. But to be fair, he finished 17th at UTMB this year, like 6 weeks after state. So he can do both. But you probably need to ask him what his preference is. But the experience that he played back to me of UTMB didn't do anything to change my views that I had, which was, without wanting to curse on your podcast, it's just, no way I'd do that. Well, it's just not my bag.
Yeah, and that's the great thing, isn't it? There's so many different types of races out there that, people will have preferences. Okay, so the second part of the question about, he's saying that 24-hour races seem to be a speciality. Would you consider multi-stage day races?
I think so. It's not something that I've came across yet. I had a couple of people, more than one person actually, mention a race like Cape Wrath to me, and being one that I could be interested in. That's a big commitment, both financially and from a time point of view, because I think it's over 5 days. But I would like to, I will experience something like that at some point. Whether I choose to go and do something abroad, if I'm going to travel and be away for 5 days, it might be better to experience something, not a Marathon de Sable, that doesn't appeal to me, but something that might be in a different country might appeal to me, like say the, what's the one, the Santiago, the Camino de Santiago or something like that. I might do something like that one day.
Right. Okay, so watch this space. Gavin Taylor, what's been the hardest or toughest point mentally or physically in training or in races? Is there any that sticks out? And in long 24-hour races, when hitting low points in the race, how do you personally deal with them? That is, if you've had any help to get you back on track.
So a couple of questions there again. So what's the hardest or toughest point mentally and physically in training or races? I think every race you do, I enjoy training. I actually enjoy the process more than racing. So I never find that I struggle to be motivated to get out, because it's kind of what I do. I'm lucky enough to be able to do a hobby that I love doing and to be, you know, semi-competitive at it. So I don't have this thing in a morning. I never have an issue where I'm like, oh, I can't bother getting out of my bed or anything like that. I just get up and go, because that's what I'm going to do. It's kind of hardwired and that's what I'm going to do. But in races, you always hit a low point, and it doesn't matter who you are and how fit you are. And the thing that you have to draw on there in those races is the experience of knowing that those low points are short-lived, that you can get through them, and that they're not finally debilitating and that's you gone from the race. Actually, it's quite the opposite. When you burn your way through a low point, actually it can become the most empowering thing you take into a race. So when you're in a low point, there's almost a bit of it saying, right, okay, this has come now, and this is something I was expecting. And now that I can deal with that and get that behind me, I've got a free run at the rest of the race. So that's kind of how I approach low points in races. And then one of the things I draw on, and I was really lucky with Rocky Raccoon and any other race I ran actually, is the support, whether it be on, you know, social media or people who are in and around you, is always something to draw on. That kind of extrinsic goal of being able to help others, you know, be happy for you and stuff. I try and draw on that as well. You know, like when I was running the last 7 miles at Rocky Raccoon, for example, when I was in real pain, and I was saying to myself, you know, the pain will go away. But I was also thinking about all the people who'd probably been tracking me for like 12, 13 hours and thinking, no, I want to see this through for them as much as myself.
Mm. Okay, great. Thank you. John Connolly, if you had a chance to choose a race prize, would you choose one, a Dutch rudder, whatever that is, a family-sized bag of Wotsits, a pallet of iron brew, or all of the above?
I would have to go with the Wotsits, because I think I've got a score to settle there. But I appreciate the offer. I think what I'm going to do is the next race I run, I'm going to see if John will offer me that selection, and I'll choose finally then. But right now, I've got that family bag of Wotsits that I need. It's a mountain I need to overcome.
Okay. I'm not sure what a Dutch rudder is. Is it a good thing to ask or not?
I don't know, but knowing John, I wouldn't Google it.
Okay, right.
Well, if you're going to Google it, don't do it at work. You may get into trouble.
Okay. David Mooney, would he give up ultra running for a date night with Billy Duffy?
Yes, I would. Billy Duffy's the guitarist with The Cult, in case right. You don't know.
No, I didn't know that.
He wrote the finest guitar riff of all time in She Sells Sanctuary. He's like my musical hero. So would I give up ultra running for Billy Duffy? Yes. Ask me that question when I'm 60, and the answer's definitely yes. I'll give it up then. And hopefully Billy's still around and playing for me to spend some time with.
Okay, next question from Amanda Hamilton. What's your favourite training session, and what's his best recipe for homemade snack fuel smoothie?
Cool. Favourite training session. One I fell in love with, Amanda, Paul kind of introduced me to over the last 6 months, and it's taken a couple of years of working with Paul to get to this, is his long runs with long efforts within them. I used to think that interval sessions were the thing I looked forward to most, like or a hill session, and I'm not being like some sort of twee, you know, the grass is always green type character with that. I just see those sessions being sessions that make the difference. So being out and being able to test yourself on a you know, whether it's a track session or a repeats or something you've done previously and see the progress you've made is great. But one that Paul worked really hard on with me in terms of training in the last 6 months is the ability to run long, but to run hard at points in that run as well. And I think that's taken me up a level from where I was last year, even from the West Highland Way.
Okay.
And my favourite, my best recipe for homemade snack, fuel or smoothie, two things there. One, my next door neighbour makes the best sweet potato brownies ever, so I just get him to make them every week. No, I don't get him to make them, he now just makes them habitually every week for us, and it's fantastic. So I'll give you his email address, and you just need to get in touch with him for that. But in terms of smoothie, a guy, Matthew Hunter, who will be known to some of the guys in the running community, he gave me a great smoothie recipe for after running efforts, was some Alpro or some milk, whatever your preferred poison is, some frozen cherries, some peanut butter, a bit of protein, and a well-ripe banana. Have that after a tough session, and it's just like brilliant. It's getting all the good stuff back in you quickly and stops you craving the Kit Kats and the Topics.
And the What's It.
And the What's It, yeah.
Okay, thank you. David Martin, since you stopped using Strava, he can't peek at your training anymore, so he'll have to ask here. Okay, he's got two questions. He's actually numbered them. So number one, in training for a 24-hour race, if you had enough time in the day, do you think more single runs as opposed to double runs are better to get the body used to running longer? And if yes, what sort of distance would you run regularly if you could?
So to that first question, no, not really. I think, you know, you're training for any race, but a 24-hour race, it's not really focused on single days and single sessions. It's the cumulative effect of a 16-week training block. So, yeah, when I'm at the peak of my training, I might be doing double sessions twice a week, you know, an easy run in the morning and a hard session, interval session, an effort at night. But I would never go out and do something like, and I assume this is where David's coming from, where I'd go out and maybe run for an hour at 8 in the morning, and then an hour at 12 o'clock, and then an hour at 4 o'clock, and then an hour at 8 o'clock at night, and do kind of 4 hours that way. I just don't think you're not allowing your body time to recover there, so you're actually breaking the effect of the training that you're trying to achieve. So you're better not to break it up too much, otherwise you're not going to get the benefit, and actually you're just probably sending yourself towards injury.
Yeah, okay. And his second question was about fueling, and he does say this is about your track racing rather than Rocky Raccoon. It says, on the track, by time or by distance, and what would you have?
By time. And the reason I do it by time is one of the things I'm pretty good at I'm pretty good at managing my nutrition. Whilst I might not eat what I plan to eat, in fact, most people, as you all know, John, I'm sure you've experienced that you start off with an eating plan that you never get near. But the important thing is working out the calories per hour that's optimal for you, and then making sure you get them in you. So for me, if I'm getting about 300 calories an hour when I'm running a 24-hour race, that's going to keep me going. And in order to achieve that, I do it really, really simply. So I'll take a bottle of Tailwind that'll be 200 calories, and that gets me both some hydration and it gets me calories, and then I'll have a snack that'll be 100 calories plus, like a sweet potato brownie, like a bit of banana bread, like some homemade biscuits or some homemade power balls, because that's kind of things that work best for me. And I do that, and I do it every hour. Not on the hour or something like that. I'll just know that in the hour that's what I'm doing, and I'll get my crew to regulate that for me. And the reason I do it by time is it means that I'm not getting, because when you get tired in a 24-hour race, you can get yourself mixed up about what you've had and what you've not had, and that regulates me on that basis.
Okay, great answer. Thank you very much. Stuart McFarlane, I think this is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek. What's he going to do with the one zillion prize money? I assume that the elites of ultra running get at least as much as tennis players, footballers, snooker players, etc.
We actually get more, Stuart. I'd be pleased to know that I'm going to donate my winner's cheque from Rocky Raccoon to Spot the Duck. So, Stuart, watch out for that money coming through the post.
Yeah.
Don't wait too long for it.
No, that's right. And then Alan Stewart is asking some particular questions. I think we've covered some of these, but we'll ask them. He said, how do you cope with running a lap-type race, especially where the lap is 20 miles, and you know you have another four to go. I struggle mentally even on a 5K route if it involves laps.
Alan, I have an innate ability to zone out. I don't even listen to music when I'm running these kind of races, even though it's something you can do. Purely because I've got this ability just to be comfortable in my own thoughts, and I break things down into a more micro level as I'm running. So I'll be like, whilst it was a 20-mile loop, as I described earlier, I actually broke it down into three loops within the 20 miles, and that just made it more manageable. And it's once you do them a few times, you just become mentally attuned to it. And for some people, they can do it, and for others, it's like it's the worst thing ever. I mean, some people think running a 400-meter track is just insane. For others, it's like it's every day.
Yeah. His second question was about what they feel like with being 6 minutes ahead with 20 miles to go. But we did. I think you've covered that one really. So
yeah.
Okay. Noni Heffron says, "What's the next big race?"
So there is no big race booked, as we were saying earlier. Hopefully, it'll be the 24-hour World Championships. But as I say, I need to stay fit and be selected for that. And then if I'm lucky to be selected for that, I'll run that in July. If not, as I said earlier, we'll send you guys a begging letter to see if you're letting into the West Ham away as a late entry, if it's available.
Oh, we'll definitely have you, no problem. Rab Lee, out of Team Handsome, who's his favourite?
Listen, it's hard to pick. When two people are so handsome, and two people are just like the epitome of hunkness, it's really hard to pick which one's the best, but I'm going to promote myself to Team Hansen and make it a three-man team, and we're going to do a six, instead of a three-legged world record, let's do something six-legged, which might be some sort of four- or five-legged concoction, and if I could be part of Team Hansen, then you'll both be my favourite for letting me in.
Excellent. Okay, the last question we've got is from Sandra Beattie, and again, this is in two parts. The first one, because it's her birthday today, she says, ask James to sing Happy Birthday to me. So are you up for singing Happy Birthday to Sandra?
You know what? I don't want to spoil Sandra's birthday by singing, because it would be the worst thing ever. But I do want to wish her a sincere and happy birthday. I seen on Facebook earlier her presents for me, which were a pair of stilettos and a hydration pack.
I know.
She's kind of in keeping with her. She's probably sitting with the hydration pack on just now and the stilettos and sitting drinking champagne. I've no doubt she's doing something crazy like that. But yeah, have a fantastic birthday. I hope you get everything you wish for.
Yeah, it's actually, there's a few other people. Ian Minty's birthday today, and so is Karen Donoghue. So
it must be
a special day for ultra runners, I think.
It must be, and I hope Ian got a nice pair of stilettos too, and Karen, I hope you did as well, but out of the three of you, I think Ian might rock them best.
Yeah, and then the final question from Sandra, which I think is a good one to finish with, she says, as early risers, I know how tiring these early morning runs can be, get by mid-afternoon. I'm lucky enough to finish early and sometimes take a cat nap. Do you get slumps, and how do you deal with them? I know you rave about your training, not just the run part, and think it plays an important part. What kind of strength training do you do? I've recently bought barbell and free weights for house, but still new to it. And last but not least, have you perfected the selfie?
So, okay, let's deal with them in the order of the past. So first question, do you get slumps and how do you deal with them? And I'm going to sound really annoying. No, I don't get slumps. I have quite a busy and hectic and pressure job, and my day, just to build this up for everyone so they understand where Sandra's coming from, because Sandra and I are kind of regular chat at 5 in the morning on social media because the two of us are up and running. My day will start about 4:45 when I get out of bed, and I'll do whatever session's been set for me, and I'll get back home to the house sometime between 6:30 and 6:30. Depending on whether it's an hour and a half or an hour or whatever that I'm doing. And then I'll be on the train to work at just before 7 a.m. So a very quick turnaround, maybe even a wee bit of stretching. I'm all prepared the night before with my stuff laid out so that I'm ready just to go after I come back in, so it's showering out. And then I'm straight into work mode at that point. And because I've engaged my brain, and actually my brain's been stimulated by the exercise in the morning, it stays stimulated all day. But I'm lucky that I get by on about generally between 6 and 7 hours of sleep a night. So I'm in bed for around about sort of 9:30, 10 o'clock at night in the main. And that does me. And if I do find myself tired a wee bit, then I just deal with that at that moment. But no, I don't get slumps. I don't find myself sitting mid-afternoon with my head in my hands. So I'm really lucky with that point, from that point of view. Second question Sandra asked, really about my training, not the run part. Absolutely, strength training and stretching and mobility is really important. I don't do much with weights or barbells or kettlebells or anything like that. But the stuff Paul prescribes most of the training I do in that regard. I'll do, as I think I mentioned before, and you were surprised by it, John, I'll do up to an hour of strength, mobility and stretching every single day. And I'll generally do that at night when we've got some trashy American TV on in front of us that you can zone out and you only need to half listen to and you can still follow the plot. And that allows me to do things like, you know, whether I do a bit of planking or a bit of core work or something around, you know, keeping the body and the legs strong. And that's, once you get in the habit of doing that every day, it becomes something that just becomes part of your running routine, even though you might not do it at the point of running. And I would implore anyone who listens to this podcast to get themselves engaged in that kind of stuff. And Sandra asks one really, really, really important question to finish with, I guess, is have I perfected the selfie? No. Sandra sets the standard and I fall way short of that, but I'll keep trying and I'll keep posting them. And one day, Sandra will delight me by telling me that's the perfect selfie.
Well done. Well, I just want to thank you so much for tonight, James. I know you've given an hour of your time there and I really appreciate it. And I think from the, you know, from the West Island Way family, we were just so thrilled to see how well you did in that race and just watch. I must admit, I probably went to bed, but I know some people stayed up and they were determined to see you in, as it were, in the middle of the night and were following you. For me, I got up. The first thing I did when I got up to see how you got on and saw that you won. So congratulations from all of us. And we certainly look forward to seeing what you've got planned for this year and in future years.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And then and to yourself and the guys involved in the race, thanks for both your interest and your support. And to anyone who's either doing the race this year for the first time or for multiple times, like many of them have done, good luck with the training, guys. I wish you well. I hope to see you out in the trails. I'll probably spend a bit of time in the West Island Way over the next couple of months. So if I see you out in the trails, be sure to say hello.
We will, certainly. Thank you very much.
Cheers, John.
Hope you've enjoyed this latest West Harlem Way Race podcast. It was great just to chat with James and get find out about his race and how that went and his plans for 2017. And just to let you know, it's 4:10 now on Friday afternoon and the new website is being moved over, or the old website's being moved over to the new one. And I've got this checker that Louise gave me and it shows you how all the servers around the world are starting to update with it. So hopefully within the next day or so, it will be fully up, the new one. It does take about a day to get around the world, I gather, so I'm told. But hopefully within a day or so, it'll all be there and you'll enjoy looking at the new website. Just going to finish with another motivational quote. Pick this up from Runner's World Motivational Quotes. And it says, "A champion is not made when he succeeds. A champion is made when you look at the time spent preparing."